ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of September. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Learning to drive can be a nerve-wracking experience and a predator's paradise. A 7:30 investigation's heard from more than 300 people who allege they were sexually harassed or assaulted by their instructors, the majority when they were teenagers. And a warning, political reporter Claudia Long's story contains details that some might find distressing.
Oh, I should probably slow down so I don't bash the car. Yeah, just
like... For Bodhi Genus, getting behind the wheel for the first time at 17 was exciting.
You can't really get anywhere without having your licence.
Learning to drive was supposed to mean freedom, but during her first lesson with a driving instructor, it became a terrible violation, something she still remembers clearly now in her early 20s.
He said, "Oh, you're doing such a good job," and that's when he leant over and put his hand in between my legs while I was driving and started, like, rubbing me.
It didn't stop there.
We kept driving, and that's also when he started saying, "Oh, the things I would do, the things I would do." And I was like, "What? The things you would do what?" And he said, "Oh, the things I would do if you were older."
She's one of the more than 300 people who contacted the ABC, recounting experiences of sexual harassment and assault by instructors. Many were still minors when they alleged the incidents occurred.
I was 16 years old, and he rubbed his hand across my chest to indicate which way to turn.
At least twice, he placed his hand on my upper inner thigh, so high that his thumb rested on my outer labia.
I was unsure where we were, and his response was, "Somewhere where I can do whatever I like and nobody can hear you scream."
We never told our mum at the time, because we felt so bad that she had paid for 10 lessons each.
Many of the learner drivers who contacted the ABC about their assault said they felt unable to go to the police because it was their word against the instructors. And for many of those who did report, their complaint went nowhere due to a lack of evidence. It's a problem barrister Molly McKendrick, who specialises in sexual assault and harassment cases, has seen play out before.
Certainly, you know, in any situation where you've got an oath on oath case, there's always going to be difficulties.
She's prosecuted similar cases against rideshare drivers.
You're strapped in quite literally, and it's not a situation where you can just, you know, run away, get away or get out of the environment.
In most states and territories, taxi drivers must have a camera filming inside the car, but there's no requirement like that for driving instructors. Just one state, South Australia, is set to change that from early 2027. Molly McKendrick says that kind of monitoring could make a huge difference.
Because you're not only seeing what's occurring in the act itself, but you're seeing the background, the context, the behaviour.
In the United Kingdom, a national oversight body tracks complaints and disciplinary action against driving instructors. But in Australia, the reporting process differs from state to state. And learners like Bodhi Genus say a nationally coordinated response is key to stopping instructors assaulting their students.
It's not okay that that's happening to so many young girls, and it needs to be stopped.
Driver Bodhi Genus, and you can see Claudia Long's story on 7:30 tonight or on iView. And if this story has raised concerns for you, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. The federal government's introducing a bill into Parliament today aiming to tighten freedom of information laws known as FOI. It says the system's outdated and clogged with trivial requests, but critics warn the changes will come at the cost of transparency. Political reporter Olivia Casely has the story.
Freedom of information, or FOI, requests allow journalists, politicians and the public to test official claims, request modelling for major spending announcements and to obtain context on ministerial decisions. Green Senator David Shoebridge says the public has a right to know.
We need the FOI system to work. I think it absolutely needs reforms and improvements. But pretty much every proposal that this Albanese government has put forward in the last 24 hours will take us backwards.
FOI requests have helped reveal major stories. Just this year, the ABC uncovered Treasury documents showing the government isn't on track to meet its pledge to build 1.2 million houses. Now, the Albanese government says the FOI system needs reform. Attorney General Michelle Rowland wants to ban anonymous requests, expand exemptions for cabinet deliberations, and impose a fee for every application. Critics call it a truth tax.
This is an extraordinary moment for the Albanese government that's already on the ropes on transparency. On most metrics, less transparent than the Morrison government. And so potential reforms to FOI, it never crossed my mind that they would make it worse, that they would be putting in charges and restricting even further access to information. This is an extraordinary misstep, I think, by the Albanese government.
The Centre for Public Integrity's Geoffrey Watson says the Albanese government is already slower at releasing documents than its predecessor and warns the reforms will only make it easier to bury inconvenient truths.
It allows us as voters to assess whether we are being properly governed for the right reasons, whether the decision makers are making the decisions for the right reasons and on sufficient information. And to take it away, I think, is a retrograde, really bad step.
The government argues more than 1 million hours were spent processing FOI requests in the 2023-24 financial year, some of them spam, threats, or frivolous requests. Mr. Watson argues there are alternative solutions.
It's a very good reason why you would acquire a better filter to remove those fake FOI requests, but it's not a good reason by bringing down the system with it. That means the bots have won.
Non-Labor MPs were briefed on the legislation late last night. It will be introduced to Parliament today.
Livia Casely there. Michelle Rowland is the Federal Attorney General and responsible for the FOI laws. She joined me earlier. Minister, thanks for joining AM.
Pleasure.
This is already being dubbed a truth tax. Why are you making it harder to get information about how governments work?
Well, as a starting point, of course, Sabra, freedom of information is a really fundamental feature of our democracy. It promotes accountability and transparency in government decision making. But you won't find a stakeholder who will say that the freedom of information regime in Australia is working as it should. And part of that is due to a number of factors, including the capability to make anonymous applications, the fact that you can have multiple vexatious or otherwise frivolous FOI applications, which are tying up the time of taxpayers and scarce government resources. What we are proposing here is to address some of those shortcomings. And I would point out that there is currently a charging regime in the Freedom of Information Act, and every state and territory, bar the ACT, actually imposes a modest application fee of somewhere between $30 and the mid-50s for people seeking to make FOI applications. So this is indeed consistent with practice that goes on in other parts of Australia, and it is designed to make sure that we can prioritise genuine FOI requests and make sure that we most expeditiously spend taxpayers' money.
Anthony Albanese previously argued for more disclosure. He said, quote, "We need a culture of disclosure. The current delays, obstacles, costs, exemptions make it easier for the government to hide information from the public. That is just not right." He said that in 2019. That quote is just as relevant today.
Well, we took to the last election a platform of delivery that we made during our first term when it comes to transparency and accountability in everything from the establishment of the NAC to reform of the Administrative Review Tribunal. We are not a government that has secret ministries. We are indeed a proper functioning cabinet government of this Prime Minister. And to make it very clear, the bill that I will introduce today does seek to clarify a number of instances where it is unclear about the scope of various exemptions and the ability to obtain information. So this is about making this clearer. And one thing I will say is that as we found out through RoboDebt, which was another example of a lack of transparency which cost people lives under the previous government, just labelling something cabinet in confidence does not make it so, and we intend to enshrine that in this law.
So how much will it cost to make an application?
Well, as I said, the
Rates that are around in states and territories are somewhere between 30 and the mid-50s for an application. We would propose that these be set out in regulations and disallowable, and also that where there are specific hardship provisions, that there is the capacity to waive them. But I'll make this very important point for your listeners, Sabra. Some 70%, over 70% of FOI requests are from individuals seeking access to their own personal information. They will specifically be exempt from any application charge.
At a time when trust with politicians and democracy is under challenge, it's counterintuitive, isn't it, that you're trying to put more information out of the public's reach?
Well, I disagree with that presumption. The fact is here that the Freedom of Information regime is dated 1982 and it is stuck in the 1980s at a time before we even contemplated artificial intelligence, before we had some government departments having over a billion documents in their systems. It is costing taxpayers in 2023-24, for example, $86 million to deal with processing, around a million hours of time taken in doing that. And that is important. But let me tell your listeners this, Sabra. We've had cases where FOI requests have been generated, sometimes around 600 of them in one instance, going to a small agency, which tied up the services of that agency for over 2 months. Now, you might think that's not important, but let me tell you what that agency was. That was eSafety. That is an organisation responsible for ensuring the safety, particularly of young people online, getting tied up doing 600 frivolous FOI requests that they are required by law to deal with. This kind of mismanagement, this kind of exploitation of these systems needs to be reined in. We need to prioritise genuine applications and we need to make sure that the FOI system is fit for purpose.
Well, the case hasn't been made. So far, the Liberals and the Greens say they will oppose it. So this is not going to get through the Senate. You'll have to change it or abandon it.
Well, let's be very clear. We intend to bring this forward to the Parliament.
It's doomed on that alone. The numbers are the numbers and they're saying they're going to vote against it.
Well, Sabra, politics is the art of the possible. And the reality here is we are going to refer this to a Senate committee for debate and ventilation. These are important reforms. And the fact is, as I said, no one who deals with the FOI system thinks that it's working properly. It is time for reform. And again, we will put this forward. Cases will be made. And we are, as a government, saying that this is an area where taxpayers and where genuine FOI applicants need to be prioritised in a system that is stuck in the 1980s. So I look forward to a fulsome debate on this. And again, I just ask, as I have with everyone I've briefed on this, including the crossbench, that they keep an open mind, that they understand the way in which this is impacting not only on individuals, but also on public servants. This is an area where I've also offered briefings from the Public Service Commissioner. The kind of vexatious complaints, applications that are made that go to, for example, sometimes sexually explicit and threatening using the FOI system in ways for which it wasn't intended, these need to be addressed.
Minister, thanks for your time this morning.
Pleasure.
The Federal Attorney General, Michelle Rowland. Australia is a continent of natural wonders. Think of the Great Barrier Reef, lush forests, even our deserts full of unique critters and plant life. But how much does nature inject into our economy? According to a study released today, the first of its kind, it's valued at about $511 billion. There are concerns governments are failing to properly protect this $500 billion asset. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
It's one of the seven natural wonders of the world, and it's right here in Australia's backyard. But would-be travellers to the Great Barrier Reef are often asking the same thing.
Isn't it dead and didn't you kill it?
That's Deborah Dixon-Smith from Dive Planet Travel, a travel agency which organises dive trips to destinations around the world. Its main focus is inbound travel to Australia.
You have to start off on the back foot. So you have to explain, first of all, what coral bleaching is and explain to people that the reef is under threat, but it's still amazing.
Her fear is that if more isn't done to protect the environment, natural assets will be lost, as well as the ability to attract visitors.
Our dive operators are no longer diving certain parts of the Ningaloo Reef because they're so badly damaged by the bleaching event this year.
Nature-based tourism contributed $17.1 billion to the Australian economy in the 2024 financial year. That's according to the Nature Economics report released today. Dr. Fraser Thompson is the managing partner of Cyan Ventures and the report's lead author.
The push we got from government was saying, well, look, if we are to increase the spending, we need a really strong fact base to justify why.
The report takes a broad look at the financial benefits of Australia's natural environment. It includes products from industries such as agriculture and timber, as well as tourism, plus the indirect benefits such as flood prevention and carbon absorption. When all taken in together, it adds up to $511 billion worth of value to the national economy every year.
It's about 20% of GDP, or roughly the same size as finance and the mining sectors combined.
The report was commissioned by the 30 by 30 Alliance, which is working to ensure the government meets its target to protect and conserve 30% of Australia's landmass and 30% of its marine areas by 2030. Tim Nicol is the director of Pew Charitable Trusts in Australia, which is a member of the Alliance.
The most exciting thing about this report is it really puts to bed this idea that we have to choose between the economy and nature. In fact, it shows that nature is actually essential critical infrastructure for our economy.
The report calls for the government to boost its spending from 0.1 to 1% of the federal budget on nature. While Environment Minister Murray Watt didn't comment on whether the government would consider boosting spending to the report's suggested 1% target, he said the government has worked with states and territories to set ambitious national biodiversity targets to address the major drivers of biodiversity decline, and says the government is investing in better environmental outcomes through multiple initiatives, including $250 million for the Australian Bushland Program.
Tanya Dendrinos there. Co-working spaces where staff from different businesses share an office space are growing in popularity. Startups and small businesses were the first to latch onto it, but big corporates are now getting involved. There's been a steady increase in the number of flexible working spaces opening during the past 5 years, particularly in the suburbs and regional centres. Advocates say it can boost worker productivity, but experts warn, not for everyone. National Work reporter Bronwyn Herbert.
Returning to work, the new mum, Sam Hargelis, got a whole lot easier when she found a co-working space near her home on the New South Wales South Coast that doubled as a daycare.
I really have been able to go back to work a lot sooner than anticipated because I'm able to still breastfeed and be involved in her day-to-day and, I guess, taking out that mum guilt because I am just a few doors down.
And finding a space in the regional city of Orange has also boosted Rosie Pritchard's work-life balance after working from home full-time.
It's provided that connection with people that I was ultimately missing when I was working from home.
According to industry group Flexible Workspace Australia, there have been more than 200 new co-working spaces added since the pandemic. Damien Sheehan from International Workplace Group says his company is opening more spaces across the country.
We're in the city, we're in the city fringe and the suburbs, and now expanding quite rapidly into regional towns, which is the most exciting part.
It's not just startups and the self-employed. Big companies are making the shift. Shared space operators say major employers, including Woolworths, CommBank and Canva, are part of a growing trend of corporates that are allowing staff to work from shared spaces. Printing company Brother offers the option to its 85 workers across Australia.
They are able to access co-working spaces which are closer to home for them, which ultimately saves them time on their commute and also money.
Brother's people and culture manager Ashley Dick says the company has benefited too.
We've been able to reduce costs, and it also has enabled us to have a lot more flexibility compared to a more longer-term fixed lease.
David Bissell, a professor of human geography from the University of Melbourne, has led research into the pros and cons of working from home.
The question of productivity is obviously a huge one, and certainly it's at the forefront of organisations and politicians' minds here in Australia, as we know.
But he cautions shared spaces aren't for everyone.
And I suppose part of that is around the social complexities of these shared spaces. You know, the very name shared indicates that, you know, different people are going to come with very different expectations of behavior, different sensitivity towards things, like any shared space.
Professor David Bissell from the University of Melbourne, ending that report by Bronwyn Herbert. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hello, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Since Donald Trump's face-to-face peace talks with the Russian president, perhaps unsurprisingly, the war continues in Ukraine. That's partly because, as part of any deal, Vladimir Putin wants Ukraine to hand over the entire eastern area of Donbass, which it won't do. Today, John Holtwanger from Foreign Policy magazine explains why Donbass is at the heart of Putin's war. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.